Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will indeed be finding common ground and taking it to the max level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. When you keep an open mind, you'll come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. You'll also see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now tonight it's my pleasure to welcome back Lisa Loving Dalton from a bullied, dyslexic, messy, freckled-faced, klutzy pixie. Lisa Loving Dalton grew into a statuesque and skillful stuntwoman, actor, director, teacher, author, filmmaker, leadership life coach, and ceremonial minister. Lisa spent years working with or stunt doubling for a galaxy of celebrity stars, including Madonna, Meryl Streep, Robert Redford, Katharine Hepburn, and a host of others. She appeared in more than 200 films, television shows, and commercials in New York, Hollywood, and Texas, including work in Ghostbusters, Money Pit, Crocodile Dundee, Married to the Mob, FX, Legal Eagles, and Splash on the big screen, and on ER, HBO's Carnival, Dr. Quinn, and Melrose Place, among many of her TV credits. In 1989, Lisa suffered a severe spinal injury that altered her path. To walk and function in chronic pain, Lisa researched medical and alternative paths that form the heart of what she shares with the world today. After her stunt career-ending injury, she resumed her passion to act and teach actors on stage and in film around the world, in Russia, Europe, and the Americas. As president of the National Michael Chekhov Association, she mentors teachers in this healthy approach to training. Always seeking and finding the silver lining, she has made the life of what has made the most of whatever life has thrown at her. She says, "I spill stuff, trip, and drip all the time, so I made a career out of it." Her advice is embrace what is as perfect. And she is the author of Murder of Talent, How Pop Culture is Killing It. And so let me welcome her back. We lost her for just a minute. Lisa, how are you?
Yes. I'm good, David. How are you?
I hope I didn't disconnect you.
No, it was just a little accident on this end.
Okay, well, accidents happen. Well, tell us what is Murder of Talent all about.
Yes, Murder of Talent is it's part social diatribe about the way that talent is treated in all aspects of our culture, from our birth and upbringing into our mentoring process and into our professional pursuits. We experience high levels of bullying, you could say. There's a tremendous amount of abuse and intimidation and harassment, and this is the same for athletes and artists of all natures, whether they're painting or whether they're singing or dancing or sculpting or acting. And then it's also part messy Hollywood memoir, going into some of the atrocities that I experienced personally on my path. And then it's part graceful masterclass, where I reveal how parents and teachers and mentors and artists can change this process, because we see massive amount of stars who are being killed. They die because they overdose, die from accidents of, drug and mood altered states, and they run away and hide from the world, and they kill their talent because they're afraid of disappointing. And then we have the whole, the culture which sort of wants to deify and then vilify and then crucify. So it addresses across the board these aspects and how that affects not just the artists that are performing, but the whole culture.
Wow. Well, I had no idea until I read some of the material on your book what was going on as far as that went. Can you tell us a little bit more about how you think this all began?
Yes, I'd love to. But the performing arts have actually 20,000 years of archaeological evidence proving that they have existed, and they have endured through all cultures around this entire planet. And so to begin with, we look at the depth of history that's been associated with performers. That by and large, I'll just give you an example. My mother-in-law was an operatic singer who sang for Mayor LaGuardia in New York when she was 11 or 12 years old. And when she hit puberty, her father forbid her to ever perform in public again because performers were considered, especially female performers, were considered to be whores. And this kind of repression of her talent subsequently caused personal problems for her throughout her life that then were transferred to her son and to her grandchildren. And, the idea that performers are low-life thieves and beggars and wanderers, gypsies, and to be disdained, to be barred and forbidden. I mean, there's stories of actors being forbidden to join the country clubs in Los Angeles. So it goes back to the past century, but way, way, way back into our history, which is weird because the history of the performer really comes out of the spiritual world. It comes from the shaman. It comes out of certainly the contemporary theater evolving out of the Greek mystery dramas and the royal theaters. And the nature of performance is itself designed to unite and heal and uplift the tribe. So it's a big contrast between what our real goal is and the goal or the way that we are treated in public. And I think it goes back to the fact that it's a very mysterious art that one cannot really codify, and it's so individualized in terms of how one achieves what one does that it scares people. And this process of denying actors their respect leads to a certain amount of desperation. There's very, very few doctors or police officers or, accountants who will go out and work for free just because they love the work, and musicians and athletes and artists, performers will perform for free whenever they get a chance. And
that's true.
It makes us vulnerable to a tremendous amount of abuse, and that back in the 20th century, there are certain approaches to actor training that became extremely popular and defined the way that the film industry evolved and defined the entire culture in our academic environments, utilizing an approach that was completely misinterpreted and misunderstood from its originator, Stanislavski. So this technique of personally recalling bad things that happened to you has been shown to trigger post-traumatic stress disorder.
Huh.
And for 100 years, this has been the state of the art training around the world. And it makes actors sick. I mean, it literally makes us mentally unstable. And so then you have the experience of actors becoming terrible role models because they can't distinguish between the character they're playing and themselves, and they have to make sure psychologically or subconsciously that we have terrible lives in reality, because if I don't have a bad life, then I won't be able to act. I will have no fodder upon which to draw. And this is a major fallacy and an extremely destructive one. And David, I believe that artists who are performing, utilizing their own personal pain, actually affect the audiences in a different way than an artist who is drawing upon their creative imagination. And I think that, you know, it's a dangerous way. It affects the audiences in negative ways.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah.
I'd never thought about that aspect, that it could lead to post-traumatic stress, delving into the psyche so deeply. That makes absolute sense to me.
Yeah, and there's a highly regarded and incredibly successful acting coach out there that's, you know, probably making, I would say, probably over $2 million a year. And in the book this acting coach wrote that I have, because I studied with this coach, the coach says that if you've been raped, that you shouldn't try to recall the rape, that you should imagine it's happening again right now.
Oh, my God.
This is horrible.
That's really
abusive.
Mm.
I had another, there was another acting coach. I saw an actor who was a big, beautiful man. I don't know if you remember the TV show Mission Impossible, the big bodybuilder. He looked very much like him. Just a big, tall bodybuilder, handsome bodybuilder. And I had worked with him on a film where he played a very nice guy, but I was asked by a director if I knew somebody who could play the right-hand henchman of a very evil general in kind of a Star Wars-like sci-fi movie. And I recommended this guy, even though I hadn't worked with him in any other capacity than him acting the role of a nice guy. And I was the coach on this film, and I got him to be really mean and nasty using these imagination-based techniques and movement-oriented techniques. But I didn't go to the set on the shoot. He presumably was doing fine, and then the director called me and said he was just too nice and he couldn't get him to be mean enough. And so I came to the set. That was a Saturday night that he called me. I came to the set Monday morning to try and work with him. And I noticed when he went to pick up some food to nibble on from the craft food table that he winced when he touched something and withdrew his hand, and I was very curious about that. And then I found out that on Sunday he had called his acting coach, who had gotten together with him and had literally taken his hand and put it on a burner and burned it in order to make him mad. And then another gal that I was coaching on the set came to me in the ladies' room almost crying, and she said, "I don't understand." She was a young girl. She was 17. She said, "I don't understand. I just saw him put his hand on a hot light. And here, this man was burning himself in an effort to try to activate his rage." And there was, I wanted to arrest. I mean, I wanted to arrest this acting coach. I mean, to me, this is horrible. And there was nothing I could do, David, to convince this man that the work he had done through his imagination and movement was very powerful, and whatever he was doing, hurting himself like this, was still not making him look like a mean and angry guy on camera. And he got fired. It's just shocking to me that this kind of thing could be happening.
What was the pivotal moment for you that helped you decide to write this particular book? Or was there one?
There was. I work with the National Michael Chekhov Association, as you mentioned. And with that, we have regular training programs where I am particularly interested in mentoring acting teachers to change this wave of bad techniques that have been promulgated for over 100 years. And there's one lecture that I do about the nature of love and about the nature of talent and about the best way to cultivate it. And that lecture is the one that I can see the artists welling up inside with a great sense of relief, with a great sense of joy, with a sense of sadness and shock, sometimes anger that no one told them these things before. And you know that as a stunt woman, I sustained that severe injury. And 3 years ago, I was able to have a surgery. And for the first time in over 20 years, I was actually able to sit long enough at a typewriter or computer to be able to begin writing. And I really wanted to write, and I couldn't figure out how to get started. And I heard on a radio program about a process of, you know, writing an ebook and a short ebook. And the suggestion was, if you're a speaker, take your most powerful lecture. And I contemplated and meditated, and I said, oh, I know what that lecture is. And then I heard another radio show where I heard about writing your book in a weekend by a Tom Birds Association. And I decided to sign up for that. I took the course virtually, and I had no idea what I was going to write. But I'd been thinking about that other, you know, oh, a good idea to write about your most popular lecture. And when I went into the meditation to begin writing in the retreat, this just poured out. And the whole book poured out in, I started it Thursday night by hand, and by Saturday, I had written the book. And
are you
from
serious?
There, I'm serious, David. It just poured out so passionately.
Wow.
And then I, of course, set about looking at it again, and you know, because it's a shock that it poured out like that, you know. And then I just really, I spent 4 months revisiting it and revising it and structuring it and sort of stepping back and looking at what I had written. And just maybe reorganizing it, trimming it a little bit, fleshing out some research that I needed to do. And while I was working on that, I was working on Falling for the Stars as well. And Falling for the Stars at one point said, "Hey, you have to let me out first." So I released that first, and then I came back to Murder of Talent after having, you know, some close colleagues, especially some specialists in the Stanislavski world, take a look at it. And one of whom was Dr. Sharon Carnegie, who wrote my foreword to me, and I consider her to be the foremost U.S. scholar on the subject of the Russian-based Stanislavski system. She's a completely fluent Russian speaker and has sat in the archives of the Moscow Art Theater. And Stanislavski was the mentor of Michael Chekhov. And it's so interesting. You got to love this, because one of the things that I reveal in Murder of Talent is Sharon's work. She was on the group, in the group of editors who were translating the original works of Stanislavski that were released in 2008 after she left the project. And part of her departing from this, I believe, was over artistic differences in the translation of Stanislavski's words. Stanislavski used the word soul, and he used the word spirit. And this had been translated in the past and continued and was blatantly translated in this brand new translation. Anywhere where the word soul was written in Russian, it was translated into mind. And anywhere the word spiritual was written, it was translated into mental. This changes the entire complexion of what the person who is the most powerful influencer on actor training. The fact that he was talking about the soul and the spirit has been removed. It was censored in the Soviet because they didn't believe in soul and spirit. And it was censored in America, and is continuing to be censored. And to me, it's just an egregious attack. It's like a rape of the spirit of the artist.
Well, it makes sense to me that would have happened, though, given Russia's previous stance, and I'm not sure where they stand today, but their stance on religion and spirit.
Absolutely. And it's part of one of the reasons why Michael Chekhov's work is very unknown, because Michael Chekhov managed to escape from Russia, and because they were going to put him to death because he was training his actors to be so spiritually powerful that they were inducing frenzy in his audiences. His curtain calls were sometimes 4 hours long. And he was just a very, very powerful impact. And that was just not going to be accepted. And even Harper Collins, or Harper and Row, I guess it was at the time, when they when they received Michael Chekhov's manuscript in 1942 in English, refused to publish it for 11 years. They extracted the most spiritual aspects of Michael Chekhov's work. So his work went out in writing, also censored by our own publishers. Original 42 manuscript was not released until 1991.
Wow.
Yeah. So
almost 50 years.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is, because the publishers are the book, the 1991 book, is underpublicized because the 1953 edited out version was pulled off the market for a few years when the 91 book came out, and then they put it back on the market with a few new segments added to it, but they never corrected the misleading editing that they did. So most people still only know that book, that second, the edited book, the censored version, is to the actor. And most people think that the 1991 version, called On the Technique of Acting, is the same book or is a lesser book that is not actually by him, when it's actually the original material. So,
fascinating.
You know, there's a battle on many, many corners.
Well, how much of your book is how much of your book is autobiographical?
About a third of it, because I do go into some of the different experiences that I had with both the times that I used personal memory that were very destructive, and teachers who taught me other approaches that were very denigrating, or teachers that were abusive. It pulls on a number of other actors' stories whose names I've not, included, but revealing. But I do, for example, I talk about my mother-in-law and how at 80-some years old, she was invited to go on an audition with me by my agent when my agent met her. And I had never known the story of her process of, how her father had forbid her. I knew that she had been an operatic singer, but I never knew what happened. And when she went on this audition, she was like a whole different person. My husband became an actor at 50, and she failed for 15 years to recognize him as an actor. Literally, David, we would sit next to her and he would be on TV and she couldn't see him on the TV. We would say, "What did you think?" And she would say, "What, were you on?" She literally couldn't see him. She called him a bum.
Are you serious? Wow.
Yes. And the week after she went on her own audition, and on the way home, she just spilled all this information about how she was so heartbroken. She wanted to be a musical theater artist, an operetta performer, and her father had forbidden her. And that following week, she called, and she had seen her son on TV twice. And his father was still alive. We went to visit him in the nursing home, and my husband had been on TV that week, and the moment we walked in the nursing home, the nurses came over and told him how they all watched him on TV together with his parents and how proud his parents were of him. And by this time, my husband was 65, and it was the first time that he heard that his parents were proud of him.
Wow. It's about time.
Yes, yes. And I really believe that my mother-in-law was so hurt by her talent being repressed and denied, and being made to feel ashamed of her desire to perform, that this created a bitter woman. And I saw her bitterness hurt her son, and I saw her bitterness hurt her grandchildren. And I think about that, and I think about how different my husband's life might have been, and my stepchildren's life, how different it might have been if she had been allowed to be the artist performer that she was innately, born to be.
Mm-hmm.
There is a price that civilization, our culture, pays when we repress talent, when we celebrate our kindergartner on stage playing a pumpkin or an angel. And then when they get to high school, we start harassing them for wanting to perform. And when they choose to be performers or artists or athletes in college, we're terrified for them, and we try to do everything we can to dissuade them from going into such an insecure profession. And when they are dissuaded, they go off in pain, and they live unhappy lives in unhappy work environments.
What is the true role of the performer in society?
It really is to unite, to uplift, to educate. The performer will defend more causes than any lawyer can, will heal more people than any doctor can, and will teach more people than any teacher can. We have scientific evidence that shows that 5 minutes in a state of appreciation boosts the immune system for over 6 hours. So every audience person who spends 5 minutes appreciating that performance, and again, we got to think our professional athletes are professional performers. Without the fans, they have no job, right? So we're talking musicians, we're talking athletes, we're talking artists of all kinds. Need witnesses, they need audiences, they need fans, otherwise they're unemployed. And it is the connection between the audience and the artist that creates something that the audience can't get without that. In that moment, that 5 minutes that they spend looking at that piece of art or cheering for that football player or golfer or crying for the loss of that character on TV or on a Hallmark commercial, by golly, they get an immune system boost because they experience catharsis. The sitcoms that may seem inane are causing people to laugh, and that laughter is a healing with huge amounts of scientific evidence on it now. And this is why this profession goes back 20,000 years, and it's why it's going to go forward 20,000 years. As long as there's humanity, there will be the desire to connect. And you know, David, when you watch a great performance, the sense of time and space is suspended. We lose track of where we are. Am I right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And what else causes us to lose track of time and space? You know, it's peak performances, meditation, and peak performances. Those are two times when time and space just stops. And when that time-space continuum is interrupted, we feel 100% connected and unified. We are back in the Garden of Eden before the separation.
That's a great metaphor. I love it.
Yeah. So, obviously, I'm passionate about it.
Yes. Well, how have your spiritual beliefs affected your entertainment career, Lisa?
I will say, David, that I was first introduced into entertainment in my Catholic school in first grade, where I had an amazing mother of some of the children who created pageantry for all the holy days. And I was so enraptured by the performers, whether it was the dying swan at Easter or something, and the maypole dance. It didn't really matter. And that was first through fourth grade. In fifth grade, I moved to a completely different part of the country into an environment that had no theater. So starting from September, by November, I had to write, produce, direct the Feast of the Annunciation. I had to act out the spiritual ritual. And the parish that I was in had no celebration of the feminine. And I spent 2 years petitioning. Can you imagine this little pixie 10, 11, 12-year-old petitioning the pastor of this church to create something that honored Mother Mary. And I created a May procession that I got to do for the school itself. And I continued creating my own theater. So my need to create festivals created my role as a producer, director, actor. And when I got through college, I wound up in a disastrous environment, very difficult. I was drug raped by a fraternity, and they subsequently slandered my name in print, distributing thousands of copies of a newsletter, which made me completely unwelcome on the campus. And it was a very, very difficult time. And during that, following that, a young man fell in love with me who turned out to be an abusive alcoholic. And I experienced, you know, severe abuse. I wound up in the hospital from his brutality. But when he was sober, he professed love and chivalry. I never touched a doorknob because he was so chivalrous. But I was with him for 4 years and became a complete atheist because God would never do this. And when I embarked on my professional acting career in New York, I really was an atheist. And it was through playing strong women in the stage that I finally got strong enough to escape from him. And when I found Michael Chekhov's technique, it reconnected me to spirituality, because his technique is one that believes in the power of the creative spirit and our ability to connect with the higher forces and the higher ego and use that as a resource. And I had plenty of horrible things that I could be recalling, and I could not use any of those techniques without being devastated myself. And so I needed a spiritual form. And once I found Michael Chekhov's work, I began to delve into all forms of spirituality in order to find what was my truth with a higher world. And thank God Michael Chekhov had such a powerful belief that performing is a spiritual act, and Stanislavski believed that theater was a spiritual act. And I now had the means of which to cultivate my spiritual nature. And when I got injured, I needed to turn to spirituality even more deeply because of the crippling effect that the medical community was unable to help me with. I became, as you mentioned, a ceremonial minister. I found that I was not in pain when I was teaching Michael Chekhov's work. And so I delved deeply into the spiritual underpinnings that he had stopped revealing to the public. And I had a very powerful mentor who was the executrix of his estate, Mal Powers. And she was the beautiful Roxanne, Jose Pereira's Cyrano de Bergerac. And she was a private student of Michael Chekhov's, and she had said to him, you are not telling me the whole truth. And she made him reveal to her, and so she then shared with me the spiritual underpinnings of Chekhov's work. And I stepped out into the world unveiling these spiritual nature of Michael Chekhov's work. And again, to great attack, because there were people who felt that I should not do that. I should not reveal the spiritual nature of Michael Chekhov's work because he himself had stopped revealing it. And I said, I don't care. You know, there's not much one can do to me after what I had already experienced in my life. You know, you can castrate me. You can, ignore me. You can condemn me. You can burn me at the stake. It doesn't really matter because I've already been through it. And I survived and I've come out, you know, a stronger person for it.
Sure. Were there any people who embraced your message?
Many, many. And I'm very pleased about that. I have teachers. I have about 70 teachers across the world who have adopted my approach, and each one of those teachers reaches hundreds of students every semester. And this has been going on now for, I'm in the 24th year of promoting this particular pedagogical approach and of reaching artists and teachers and certifying them to be able to teach with this. And those people are training other students. I went to a conference where there were over 4,000 people, the Southeastern Theater Conference, over 4,000 people attending this. And I went sort of under the radar. So it was the first conference I'd gone to where I wasn't a judge or a presenter or, you know, a master teacher at. I just was a nobody when I went there. And there were over a dozen workshops being offered about Michael Chekhov's work, which was, you know, that was a dream come true. And I sat in a class where two graduate students were teaching, and I was between a young actor and a professor who were in their first Michael Chekhov class. They didn't know there was a difference between Anton Chekhov, Michael's uncle, who's a renowned playwright, and Michael Chekhov, the actor. And I watched these two people's eyes being opened by these two young grad students who were the students of one of the first teachers that I certified. And I saw, it was like my grandchildren opening the eyes and hearts and minds of a young man and of a well-established professor. And David, to me, that was absolutely a dream come true.
That I can imagine.
You know, this young man had showed up at like three or four of the other Chekhov classes because of what happened in that class. And his life was changed for the better. And this is, you know, imagine, let me say, David, someone like Anthony Hopkins, he uses Michael Chekhov's techniques. And you look at his character in Silence of the Lambs, his Hannibal Lecter character. He loves this character. The artist loves this character. And we, many, many years after having seen that movie, we get chills and we have vivid images of that movie. And we love Hannibal Lecter as well. We love to hate him. We love to be scared by him. We are intrigued by him. And we are astonished that one of the most, you know, evil characters ever rendered in the history of cinema delights us. And that can only happen when the artist bears great love. One can render, it's as if from a spiritual perspective, when one can render evil artistically through the power of love, it's like you pluck a little bit of evil out of the cosmos and transform it. So it doesn't need to be acted out in reality because it's been transmuted by love. Mm. And that's an incredible service. And that's possible with this approach.
Well, that makes absolute sense to me.
Very, very cool.
Well, obviously, we have had many, many talented people in this profession over time. Do you think that society is more obsessed with celebrity now than they have been in other eras?
I do. I think that our rapid communications via the internet created a hunger and a thirst for product. And so we have things like BuzzFeed and Instagram and just so many, many resources, blogs everywhere, and people vying for attention. And so today's celebrity may or may not have talent. And we create celebrities sometimes just out of their bad behavior, mm-hmm. shocking behavior. And then we role model them. And this is very, very dangerous. We take celebrities who are really doing their best to live a healthy and functioning life, and we track them every split second, and we don't give them a moment's peace, so that if they wear one bad shirt out in public, or they venture out with a hair out of place, or they lose their temper for a half a second, it's captured and catapulted into the public eye. And the public keeps buying it. So we need to stop buying it, because that kind of scrutiny of our stars and celebrities leads our celebrities into high levels of paranoia. And it becomes extremely difficult for our celebrities to have any human connection with anyone, because they don't know whether a person is relating to their celebrityhood or to them as a human being. And they are very different things. You know, that person needs to go to the bathroom just like we do. And they need to wash their hair just like we do. And they've got their bad days and their good days. And for us to crucify them for having a bad moment is trying to hold them to a standard we would never hold ourselves to. And when we do that, when we crucify and vilify our stars and our role models, most of the time we are doing that just to make ourselves feel better. And David, I don't think putting someone else down ever makes you feel better.
No, it doesn't. And yet that seems to be part of human nature. People just are not willing to take a look at the things within themselves that need healing, and they're so quick to point out the faults of other people, and who's going to fall under the lens of that more completely than somebody that is a celebrity.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well,
so
tell me how...
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say one of the antidotes to this, to the childhood training process, where in a study done on peak performers, these would be Olympic champions and master genius musicians, artists, etc. They looked at what these people had in common, and they arrived at a few observations. And one was that in the early years, all of these geniuses received mentorship that induced enthusiasm for what they loved, rather than emphasizing techniques. So if it was a pianist, the mentor, the teacher, the parents, the family cheered the child on. Didn't matter how bad they were. Didn't matter how much talent, so to speak, they demonstrated. They just were cheered on. And when the child stuck with the particular thing for a number of years, then became the time for the mentors, the parents, to start looking for someone who could provide actual technique. And the reason that this was the most successful pattern is because during those enthusiasm years, those cheering them on regardless of the quality of the work or art or play, the individual built up joy connected with what they were doing and belief in themselves that they then could withstand the adjusting, the correcting, and the support that they got as they matured in terms of gaining technique. And technique is important regardless of how much talent innately one may have. It's technique that allows a person to become a professional who can repeat the performance time and time and time again. And so what happens for the celebrities who become famous and then are subjected to this criticism is if they do not have within themselves this core of faith in themselves and belief in who they are as an artist, and that the art is a separate thing from who they are in terms of their value as a human being, that they, when you have that belief, that core of love, that core belief, you are then able to sustain this criticism and not turn to drugs, alcohol, mood alteration, and other reality-altering conditions. So that's what we need to do. We need to get into the classroom. We need to get into the family unit and train parents and teachers and siblings how to honor the desires of the children completely and without judgment.
Well, that's beautiful.
One reason, David, in Murder of Talent, I created my own graphics. I drew some of my own figures in there because, starting from kindergarten, I developed a terrible worry about my ability to draw, and I never got past it. And when I was in college, in my costume, I was a master seamstress, and my costumer adored me. I made all the costumes that he gave me. But in my design class, when I drew my first set of plates, trying to show my designs, he invited me to describe and sort of act out my costumes. And I worked in a fabric store, so I had great swatches and things like that. And afterwards, he said, "Your ideas are great. I'm giving you an A. But Lisa, next time I ask the class to draw their designs, you don't have to. Just come and meet with me and do what we just did.
Aww.
Because I can't understand your drawings." So again, it was like, oh my God, I draw so badly that I couldn't even communicate this. And so part of my own, drawing talent was murdered. And so I made my own drawings.
Good for you.
Little drawings there. And it just so that I could awaken my talent, because one of my beliefs is I don't care how old you are. If you've always wanted to do something, you should do it. you should do it now. And I don't care how bad you are. I don't care if you think you're a terrible singer. I don't care if you think you can't draw or if you think you can't act. There is a choir out there. There is a community art program. There's a community theater that will welcome you and bring you into your opportunities to perform whatever it is that you wanted to.
That's a beautiful message.
And that really is my message, David. I want people to live from love instead of from mm-hmm. fear. And the more we can live, I mean, until, David, I just did a solo show, performed it in the Fort Lauderdale Fringe Festival, and I'm now touring it. And it's called Big Bumps, Stunt Gal's Voluptuous Roller Coaster Life. And
oh,
in that
I love
movie,
it.
I love this title. Yeah. And you know, in Falling for the Stars, my book, and there's lots of stories about how my voluptuous chest got me in trouble as a stunt woman. So it draws on those stories, but it was the first time in that I am flashing back to my childhood and to these incidents, and it was the first time that I went public about the drug rape by the fraternity. And it was the first time in over 40 years where I freed myself from being frightened that the article that was published about me slandering me so badly, I lived for over 40 years in fear that it would come out in public. And so last month, I published it from the stage, of the Broward Center in Fort Lauderdale. And finally, those people hold no fear over me. And I can ask myself how many times in my career in Los Angeles that I literally thought, wow, I better not become famous because that article will come out again.
Hmm. Well, you took power back into your own hands when you did that.
I did. And I just want people to do that in whatever way. And hopefully your way, you know, is to step through a fear that was less paralyzing than mine. But every fear, no matter how small, can be paralyzing. And so no matter how small you think your fear is, just jump through it. Go through it.
That's great advice. Well, Lisa, what's the best way for people to get in touch with you, and where are the best places for them to find your books?
My website is lisadalton.com, and the books are on there, and they're on Amazon, where they were Amazon bestsellers, and they are also on Barnes & Noble, and they're an ebook and paperback. And if anyone's interested in my crazy zany show, it's very, very funny and a bit, you know, painful and sad. They can also reach me through lisadalton.com. And I love to hear from people, David. So they can email me, lisa@lisadalton.com. And there's an email list they can sign up for. They can get free chapters. And there's some real fun stuff with the books on that site.
Beautiful. Well, Lisa, the hour went so quickly. Thank you for joining me again.
I'm so honored that you invited me back, David, and I love chatting with you. I love your questions. Thank you again.
Well, best wishes to you with all of your endeavors. So once again, we come to a close. Let's take a moment to pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There's no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who can and will have a spiritual experience when we let it be. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize. Good night and God bless.